I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. What happened in Hanoi? The summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un came to an abrupt halt early yesterday morning. Nicholas Eberstadt of the American Enterprise Institute shares his perspective on the prospects for peace on the Korean Peninsula. Last night, the Maryland House of Delegates voted to censure Democratic delegate Marianne Lasanti for her use of the N-word at a social gathering of lawmakers in Annapolis earlier this year. Lasanti has so far refused calls for her to resign. Luke Broadwater of the Baltimore Sun looks behind this and other local headlines. And an art exhibition at the Goyette Contemporary Gallery is inspired by Madam C.J. Walker, the first African-American woman millionaire. We'll meet the artist, the curator, and Walker's great-great-granddaughter. First, the news. And good afternoon. Welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Today, it's the Midday News Wrap. A little later, we'll take a look behind some of the big local headlines of the week with Luke Broadwater of the Baltimore Sun. But we begin today with the summit between President Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un of North Korea. They met this week in Vietnam. It was their second face-to-face meeting, and it came to an abrupt end early yesterday when they skipped a planned lunch and a signing ceremony and returned to their respective capitals. My guest is Nicholas Eberstadt of the American Enterprise Institute. He is an expert on both North and South Korea. He also writes about domestic issues. His latest book is called Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis. Nick, welcome back to Midday.
Thanks for inviting me again.
So when you wrote a piece in the New York Times before the summit began, you observed that Kim bested Mr. Trump in Singapore. This time it appears that he's walked away from a deal rather than make a bad deal. How do you compare the two summits, the one in Singapore and the one in Hanoi?
Well, Tom, the summit in Singapore was a sort of a skirmish. It wasn't very high stakes, but everything that was on the table, Kim Jong-un took home. He was able to frame the question of the nuclear issue exactly the way the North Korean side frames it. We used their language in our joint statement. For some reason, President Trump praised this jail master of the worst humanitarian disaster in the world today, in rather effusive terms, after the summit. And he also unilaterally cut back on some of the joint training exercises that the U.S. and our South Korean allies used to prepare against the risk of North Korean aggression. For this summit, for the Hanoi summit, it looked as if America was willing to make a bad deal, or at least in my interpretation, a bad deal. And for very little in return, the United States was willing to begin the process of diplomatic relations, liaison offices between the two sides, that the U.S. was willing to come up with a peace declaration, even though obviously there's nothing approaching peace between North and South Korea in the divided peninsula. And possibly even give some relief to the sanctions that have maybe brought North Korea to the negotiating table. That would have, in my view, that would have been a bad deal for the U.S. and a quite good deal for North Korea. Things seem to have broken down, at least according to what we in the cyber sphere hear. Things seem to have broken down because the North Korean side wanted an even more advantageous deal for Pyongyang. They, according to what we read in the press, the North Koreans yesterday insisted on total relief, total dismantling of sanctions right now for unclear, unspecified reciprocal actions by the North. So at the moment, until we all hear more, the interpretation I would go with is that the North Korean side committed a serious overreach at the negotiating table, and that's what brought things crashing down.
And to your point about why the things crashed, are we exactly sure that that's the reason? I mean, this is what Mr. Trump asserted in his press conference before he left Hanoi. Secretary Pompeo said the same thing, that they wanted a complete end to sanctions in return for dismantling of one particular nuclear site. Are we to believe Mr. Trump and Mr. Pompeo in this instance?
Well, the North Korean foreign minister yesterday came out with a statement saying this was not the case, that they were only asking for a step-by-step relief from sanctions. So the stories are inconsistent at this point. It seems quite apparent that the North Korean side is desperate for sanctions relief. Whether they were so desperate that they brought the negotiations to a crashing halt, I suppose remains to be seen as more information comes out from the two sides.
Nicholas Eberstadt is my guest. He's with the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. He is an expert on North Korea. We're talking about the summit that came to a very abrupt end just a couple of days ago in Hanoi between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. And Nick Eberstadt, it seemed that once again, President Trump sort of dipped Kim in a big vat of credibility, speaking in particular about the very sad death of Otto Warmbier, a young American student who was in North Korea, who returned to the United States in very bad shape and died soon thereafter. Once again, as sort of almost parallel to what he had said in Helsinki when he said that he believed what Vladimir Putin told him about Russian transgressions, he said that he believed Kim Jong-un when it came to Mr. Warmbier. The fact that he has even agreed to meet with Kim, not once but twice, and then he has that kind of rhetoric, supposedly or you know apparently supporting Mr. Kim's credibility. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, I have to say, in full disclosure, that I'm a founding member of the U.S. Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, so I would much rather have seen the U.S. raise and press the human rights question at both summits, which we did not do. I think that was disappointing. And additionally, I think it was probably short-sighted, because I think pressing the human rights issue is going to eventually help us with the sorts of changes that will bring about a peace, a lasting peace in the Korean Peninsula. That said, I will play devil's advocate for President Trump, and let's call it President X instead of President Trump. If an American president is meeting with a North Korean dictator, and the question of the torture and, let's call it what it is, murder of that poor American student comes up, the president has one of two choices. He can say what I think we all know is the truth, which is that this torture murder could not have been unknown to the jail master of the 25 million people who live in that outdoor jail, which would bring the future prospect of top-level negotiations ever to a end, or it could make some sort of demurral. And Trump chose to say, I have to, for now, take him at his word. That's kind of the ugly side of power politics, I guess. The alternative, however, I think, is calling him a liar and a murderer, which he is. But it's a little difficult to do business with the liar and murderer after you've called them out in public. It's a choice he had to make.
Has Kim's standing on the world stage been enlarged, and has Mr. Trump's standing on the world stage been either enlarged or diminished by these two summits now?
Certainly, it's been a windfall for Kim Jong-un. He has been able to reintroduce himself to the international community as a seemingly more reasonable and less menacing person, as an international statesman, rather than the monster that I think many of us know that he is. So it's certainly been an unalloyed benefit for him. Exactly how it has affected President Trump's international reputation, I think, is at the moment an incomplete. We'll have to see if the president is hungry for a deal with North Korea, whether he is the one who heads back to the negotiating table, asking the other side to join him, or whether he gives a reason that can be explained clearly and compellingly to the international community for why these negotiations broke down and why North Korea's international nuclear threat has to be regarded as a genuine problem, not just for the U.S., but for a whole lot of other countries, too.
You mentioned some of the expectations that a lot of people had going into this summit, and that some of those expectations would have ultimately ended up in a bad deal for the United States. But they included, you know, declaring an end to the Korean War, establishing these liaison offices that you mentioned, a swap for the destruction of the main nuclear facility for the easing of sanctions. And, of course, this is all in the circle of Mr. Trump's assertion that it's his personal relationship with Kim that will win the day. This is the art of the deal talking here. Mm-hmm. So, obviously, it didn't win the day. And there are reports yesterday morning that Mr. Trump has asked President Moon Jae-in of South Korea to intercede. What do you make of that?
Well, it's very hard to win at the negotiating table with a revisionist state. And the North Korean government is almost a poster child for a revisionist state. It doesn't believe in the legitimacy of the South Korean government. It doesn't believe that the Republic of Korea has a right to exist. It doesn't believe in the U.S. Security architecture in Northeast Asia. Their diplomacy is a revisionist diplomacy which uses brinkmanship and broken promises and strategic deception, and a diplomacy in which they'll walk away from a deal they agree to as soon as it appears disadvantageous. And if that all sounds wild, take a look at what's happened in negotiating with North Korea over the last 25-plus years. North Korea started out as a poor, small, remote country without nuclear weapons, and now it's a poor, small, remote country with nuclear weapons because they outclassed all of their negotiating partners over this long period of time.
But is there any evidence, for example, they do seem to be quite concerned about the sanctions. Of that concern, do we have any more insight into the level of their concern about the sanctions now that this summit has fallen apart?
The two things we have seen in the last decade or so that the North Korean government seems to have been alarmed about are the raising of human rights, the way the UN did with its Commission of Inquiry, because I think that even in North Korea, they've got the internet and they can Google the Nuremberg trials just as easily as we can. And the imposition of serious financial and economic sanctions. Back under the George W. Bush administration, there was the so-called Banco Delta Asia episode where money was frozen, North Korean illicit funds were frozen, and the North Korean government reacted in a frenzy about that. Now we have the economic sanctions, the so-called maximum pressure campaign, and the North Korean government appears to be truly alarmed about that. I think we can understand why they might be, because the North Korean economy is almost uniquely vulnerable to international sanctions because it's so distorted and financially dependent upon outside largesse. If the if the United States and the international community continues the maximum pressure campaign in some fashion, generally speaking, and I don't know what the timeline is, but generally speaking, I think we can expect the North Korean regime will eventually have to spend down its internal financial reserves and use up its strategic reserves of food and oil. So far, it looks as if the sanctions have had no effect. But if you were inside the fortress, you'd be wanting things to look that way exactly to the people who are besieging you.
Kim was asked by a reporter in Vietnam a question, and surprisingly he answered it. He was asked whether or not he was really prepared to denuclearize. And Kim responded, "If I was not, I wouldn't be here." In your view, is there any evidence since Singapore and Hanoi that Kim really would, in fact, give up his nuclear arsenal?
The North Korean side has a formulation that the Americans didn't pay very much attention to. In fact, the U.S. side signed on to this North Korean formulation in the joint document at the Singapore summit. Instead of talking about denuclearization of North Korea, they talk about the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. So what does that mean?
I mean South Korea, too.
It means South Korea, too, but since South Korea has no nukes, how do you denuclearize a country that doesn't have any nukes? You cut their alliance with the nuclear power of the U.S., and you get the American forces out. Up until now, the North Korean posture has been, we're going for denuclearization of the peninsula, pal, and we start with you. And after we've cut the relations with the defense alliance between South Korea and the U.S., then we have an arms control question. We will engage in arms control with Washington. And if Washington wants us to have 10 nuclear weapons, no more, Washington better draw down so that they just have 10 nuclear weapons, no more. It's a pretty big bid.
And there really doesn't seem to be a whole lot of consensus about what even the notion of denuclearization means to the both sides. Yeah. Nicholas Eberstadt holds the Henry Wendt Chair in Political Economy at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. In addition to his expertise on North and South Korea, he writes about a number of domestic issues as well. His latest book is a good one. We talked about it here on Midday just a couple of years ago. It's called Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis. Nick Eberstadt, thanks so much. I appreciate it. Have a good weekend.
Same to you. All the best.
It's the Midday News Wrap. After a quick break, a look behind some of the big local headlines of the week with Luke Broadwater of the Baltimore Sun. And then later on, a new art exhibit celebrates the work of the first black woman millionaire, Madam C.J. Walker. Lots more coming up. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday on our program, Jill Abramson, the former executive editor of the New York Times, will join me to talk about her latest book, Merchants of Truth, The Business of News and the Fight for Facts. We'll talk to Jill Abramson about the intersection of journalism and business Monday on Midday. It's a terrific book, and it is not a complete stranger to controversy itself. We will explore all of that Monday. And a new exhibit at the Goya Contemporary Gallery pays homage to the civil rights activist and entrepreneur Madam C.J. Walker. We're going to talk about that a little bit later on today's program. But now the Midday News Wrap continues with Luke Broadwater, the State House reporter for the Baltimore Sun. He joins us on the line from Annapolis. Harford County Democratic Delegate Mary Ann Lasanti is under increasing pressure to resign following her use of the N-word to describe a district in Prince George's County. The Maryland House voted to censure her last night. Luke, how you doing?
Hey, good afternoon. Hi, Tom.
So what can you tell us about the latest in the saga of Mary Ann Lasanti?
Well, just as you mentioned, Tom, last night the House of Delegates voted 137-0 to censure Delegate Lasanti At the same time, Speaker Michael Bush stripped her of her committee assignments, not just leadership in the committees, but all committee assignments. So she essentially has very little to do now in Annapolis. She can show up to the floor, she can introduce a bill, but she basically has no work to do after that. The Legislative Black Caucus feels that this move now will pressure her even more to resign because her constituents will see that she cannot be an effective legislator, in their view. Today, the NAACP and other groups, the Legislative Black Caucus, CAR, others, the ACLU, had a press conference, again, calling for her to resign in very strong terms. She was not present at the House of Delegates chamber session this morning. No one's seen her today in Annapolis. It's still all up in the air, as best I can tell. But last night she did give comments to the media where she said she wasn't going to resign, and she was going to try to ride this out.
We need to send a shout out to your State House colleague, Ovita Wiggins from The Washington Post. She's the one that first reported Ms. Lasanti's use of the N-word. She was in a cigar bar, I guess, with several colleagues from the General Assembly. Can you reconstruct, based on Ovita's reporting and the conversations you've had since then, Ovita's story, I think, came out Monday.
Correct.
What exactly did she say, and in what context did she say it?
Yeah, I think first you're right that we should give a lot of credit to the Post here, because without their reporting, this probably would have remained hidden. It was sort of a rumor swirling around Annapolis that this had happened, but they were really able to nail it down through some really dogged reporting and get it on the record. And then that happened Monday, and then, you know, all hell broke loose from there. What happened from Delegate Lasanti's point of view, from other delegates that were there that night? There was drinking going on. They had been out at a dinner. They went to the cigar bar afterwards. Apparently, there was more drinking at the cigar bar, and she said this phrase she said the N-word and used it to refer to a district in Prince George's County, and it was, she claims she doesn't remember saying this now, but she's taking responsibility for saying it. She's kind of gone back and forth in her public statements. Sometimes she accepts responsibility and admits it, then other times she says she's not sure if she did. But one of the delegates who was there that night stood up at the press conference today and said for her to say she didn't say it is calling everybody else in that room a liar, because we can attest to her using this racist slur.
Yeah, as part of Ovita Wiggins' reporting, she asked her about it, and as you say, Delegate Lasanti at one point said, I don't recall it, I don't recall much of that evening. But then she was asked whether she'd ever used the slur, and she said, quote, I'm sure I have. I'm sure everyone has used it. I've used the F word, I've used the Lord's name in vain. And then a little later, she said, I'm sickened that a word that is not in my vocabulary came out of my mouth. So it's a very interesting back and forth kind of ping ponging about whether
she's inconsistent, isn't it? I mean, and apparently she said the thing about I use that word sometimes. Doesn't everybody? It's just like the F word or the Lord's name in vain. She said that to the Legislative Black Caucus as well in a closed door session. So in a public interview, and then also to others, because that's what Delegate Barnes relayed to the media just today, that she had used that same language in their meeting. I don't know what her strategy is completely here from her, but she has been inconsistent in her public statements, and I don't think that is giving or winning her any friends. I'll say that.
About 12.8% of her constituents in Harford County are African American, and we should say that the calls for her resignation come from both sides of the aisle. The chair of the Democratic Party, Maya Rockamore Cummings, has called for her to resign. A number of fellow Democratic lawmakers have, as has Republican Governor Larry Hogan. So she certainly, I don't think the calls for her resignation are going to attenuate any in the next few days. Is she in a technical sense, you know, having been stripped of her committee assignments? You mentioned that she's got a whole lot less to do than she used to. But is it as a practical matter possible for her to, in fact, represent the voters in Harford County?
Well, so the House of Delegates and Speaker Bush say that they cannot, like, strip her of her floor privileges. So she still can vote on things and she can still introduce bills. So at a very basic level, she can provide some level of representation. But in terms of working on bills in committee and adding amendments and voting against, I mean, the floor votes is a very small portion of a delegate's work, and a lot more of the work is done in committee. So she has been stripped of a lot of the work of representation for her district. So I don't know. I mean, the Harford County NAACP and some of her constituents were here today in Annapolis asking for her to resign, and a reporter asked them, you know, Delegate Lasanti says that she has support in Harford County, and they all laughed. So they don't believe that's the case any longer, and so they think she should step down.
Luke Broadwater covers the State House in Annapolis for the Baltimore Sun. He's a frequent guest and a good friend of our program. You're listening to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Luke, the future of Pimlico and the future of the Preakness continuing to be held at the Pimlico Racetrack in Northwest Baltimore, where does that stand? Your colleagues Jeff Barker and Pam Wood, Kevin Rector, have written about this in the last few days. It seems like the Preakness will at least stay at Pimlico for the immediate future.
Yes, that's right. So this is all unfolding before our eyes as we speak. Actually, I came in from a rally that's outside right now, the Save Preakness rally, the Keep the Preakness in Baltimore rally that's going on right outside the State House at the moment. I would say a few dozen people are out there asking lawmakers to do what they can to stop the Stronach group from moving the race.
And they are the owners of Laurel and Pimlico, we should mention.
Correct, yes. And so there are two competing bills that are going to be heard at 1 o'clock. And one is legislation that would authorize funds to build a super track in Laurel, which many people from Baltimore see as a first step towards moving the Preakness. And that's what the Stronach group has said they want to do. The other bill is legislation from the city delegation that forces Stronach to participate in a work group and task force to build a $400 million rebuild of the Pimlico race course, which they see as an effort to keep the race in Baltimore. So there's these two competing pieces of legislation that are going to be heard at around the same time this afternoon. So this is very much in flux. But what we do know, what's come out over the last couple of weeks, is Stronach saying on the record, we want this super track to be in Laurel. We want the state to help fund it, and we want to move the race. So they've now gone on the record. That's been sort of hinted at for a long time, but them saying it openly and publicly has caused a lot of angst. And, you know, the mayor helped bus people down today. So they all have their green T-shirts on, Save the Preakness. So she's trying to rally some community support for this race thing in Baltimore.
And for the Stronach group to refurbish Laurel, as you mentioned, they would need state funding. Does that mean the state has some leverage in that regard? And the other leverage that the state apparently has, and this is something that Delegate Sandy Rosenberg mentions every time we talk about it, is that there is an actual law that says that the Preakness cannot be moved from Pimlico for reasons other than, you know, act of God or natural disaster. Your paper, The Sun, has reported that since 2013, 87% of the money that Stronach has received from the state to pay for track renovations at either Laurel or Pimlico, 87%, almost all of it, has gone to Laurel. None of it's gone to Pimlico, or almost
none. That's right. Yeah, that was some good digging by my colleague Doug Donovan, who really poured through all the public documents available on how the racetrack money has been spent. So But you're right. There is this law in the books that the General Assembly put in that the race has to be run in Baltimore. That said, so there are a couple options. If a deal cannot be reached, if they cannot reach a compromise and they remain at loggerheads, Sternich has a couple of options. One, they can try to get the law changed. There is, I think they have some, I mean, we in Baltimore always think about Baltimore, but actually there's not a small contingency between Anne Arundel, Prince George's, and Howard County, who have at least some interest in supporting Laurel. So there may be some support there for a legislative effort. The other thing that's been talked about is possibly a lawsuit and to try to invalidate this law. I think we're a few years off from that because, as we know, the race is going to be in Baltimore for at least the next 2 years. They could try to say this law is illegal. The state can't tell us where to run a horse race and let the courts decide. So I think if it keeps getting nasty like it has been, and it's getting increasingly nasty, it could come to something like that.
I want to talk about the issue of whether school resource officers in Baltimore City should be armed. You've written about this. Two or three weeks ago, the school board here in Baltimore voted 10-0 to disallow school resource officers from carrying firearms. There was a bill introduced in the legislature in Annapolis to make that possible. They held another vote a couple of weeks after a shooting at Frederick Douglass High School, and the result was completely different.
Yes, that's right. And I think my colleague Talia Richmond was at that meeting bringing us live coverage of that. But they went from a 10-0 vote, the city school board went from a 10-0 vote against arming city school police officers inside school buildings to an 8-2 vote in favor of it. And so this is in reaction, of course, to the shooting inside of Frederick Douglass High of a staff member. And Cheryl Glenn's, the chairwoman of the city delegation's reintroduction of a bill that she had withdrawn earlier this year that would give the city school police the authority to carry their firearms inside the buildings. This is something the union has wanted for a long time, and this may be the year it happens, given that the school board has signed off on it and Delia Glenn says she's forcing a vote on it. It remains to be seen whether the whole city delegation will support it. And I think we'll see that come up in the next couple of weeks with an up or down vote on whether to back this bill.
Is that a bill that's currently in committee? Does it need to be pumped out of committee and get to the floor? And if so, do you think it has a chance of making it to the floor in this session?
Well, it's in the Rules Committee right now because it was introduced late because of when she withdrew it and then put it back in. And so it does take an extra step to get that to the floor. But if the city delegation votes to support it, it will likely pass the both chambers. The issue is whether there are the votes there among the city delegation. There's 22 city lawmakers in Annapolis, and the rest of the state will defer to them on this issue, I believe. Although, I will say, Senate Republicans are pushing for it, too, and there are no Republicans in Baltimore, so it does have the GOP support.
Luke Broadwater covers state politics for the Baltimore Sun. Luke, I very much appreciate your reporting, as always, and your time this afternoon, so I guess you're going to head back out to the rally and see what's going on with the protests.
Thanks, Tom. Have a great afternoon.
All right, appreciate it. Thank you. Coming up, a new exhibit at the Goya Contemporary Gallery here in Baltimore pays homage to the civil rights activist and entrepreneur Madam C.J. Walker. We'll talk about it on the other side of this very quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.